we can consider. The first appendix does cover, it takes two stories and makes them into one. Who's the man's name in chapter 17 we're going to talk about? Now, that's not Micah the prophet. This is a different Micah. So we'll talk about his story. And then the 18th chapter is talking about the migration of the tribe of Dan from its original inheritance clear up north to the northern part of the kingdom, and how these stories overlap. There is a connection between the two stories, and the 18th chapter makes that plain. But you notice in these two stories, the focus is on things like what? Idolatry? That's certainly consistent with the days of the judges. Would there be an indication of some deterioration of true worship? Well, there would be. Micah wanted his own priest, and he got him. But there's no indication that he was of the right lineage. He was from the right tribe. But is there any evidence that he was from the family of Aaron? The story doesn't say. So, and even if he was a priest in an idolatrous shrine with all those gods and idols in the house. The unlawful priesthood. And these points here, the last bullet point, again, they fit right in with the overall theme of the book. Very weak spiritual conditions that are found in Israel during this time period, when it was just a cycle of sin and rebellion and unlawful religious activity. Okay, let's look now at the chapter 17. This is the story of Micah, and it's a very short chapter, one of the shortest, if not the shortest chapters in the book. Where was Micah from? All right, he's from the hill country of Ephraim, and how does his story, I mean, we'll just sort of jump right into the middle of his story. What's happened before that we sort of pick up in the middle of it? Verse 2. Alright, how do we learn that Micah took those pieces of silver? Yeah, he confesses to his mother that he did it. And apparently based on verse 2, what had his mother done? Yeah, she pronounced a curse upon the one that had done it. And so apparently Micah finally comes and says, well, you know, I'm the one that took him. He fesses up. He confesses that he was the thief. He was the guilty party. So verse 2 are words to his mother. The 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me. I took it. Was it good to confess sin? Well, yeah, it's always good to confess. But he had let whatever length of time go by, and finally he says to his mother, I'm the one that took it. So now what does his mother do at the end of verse 2? Oh, so she tries now to undo the curse now with a blessing. Now pronounces a blessing upon her son. And she does something else. This is in question 3, rather. And it's just sort of a play on words. How did his mother show her gratitude for the situation the house worked out now? Would it be in a way that you would recommend? Of course not. What does she do? All right. So she says, I'm going to wholly dedicate the silver to the Lord. Now watch what she says. I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son, to make a graven image and a molten image. Now, therefore, I will return them to you. So he took them unlawfully first. Now he confesses, I'm the one that took them. He gives them back to her. And what does she do? She gives them right back to him. For what purpose? But now this is to the Lord, see. This is to Jehovah. But we're going to make an image out of this. Now, I've cited you in question 3 back to Deuteronomy 27 and verse 15. Remember those two chapters back there where you had the blessings on Mount Gerizim and the curses on Mount Ebal that were said in those last speeches by Moses? And verse 15 was one of the curses that was uttered on Mount Ebal. And Moses said basically, cursed is he that makes a molten or a graven image and sets it up in secret in his house. Is that what's going to happen with Micah here? That's precisely what he's going to do. And each of those verses back in the curses, the people responded how? They said, amen. Amen. So be it, Moses. What you're saying, that is right. We agree with that, And we take that curse upon ourselves. So here's another indication. What's happened since the day when those curses were uttered on Mount Ebal? Now during this time period, what is at least this household willing to do? Go and fly right in the face of what Moses said. You're right. Willingly disobey. So again, we see behavior that's consistent with the overall disposition of the period here. A reluctance to obey Jehovah, a reluctance to not walk strictly with respect to how the law legislates on these matters. You're right, Freddie. They don't even realize that they're disobeying. Their heart is so given over to idolatry, chasing after these other gods, and maybe just to sort of legitimize something, we'll do it in the name of the Lord, just to kind of, you know, give it some legitimacy or credibility. It's all thrown in the same hopper. You're right, it's just mixed up. And we can't serve God with a watered-down religion, can we? It's got to be all His way. We can't do things our own way. So the images are made, verse 4, and you'll see there that Micah then sets them up in his house. Did he use all the silver? He only used 200 pieces of the 1,100. So however big a image that made, we don't know. But all the silver was not used. But then Micah does something else, and I'm going to call this, he expands his religious shrine. What else does he do on top of setting up these images? All right, he made an ephod. Now, what's an ephod or an ephod? Okay, it's the vest-like garment that's worn by who? By the priest. Now, did Aaron and his sons have to wear an ephod? Yes, God specified that. We can go back in the law. We can read all the regulations that God set forth for the priest and their garments. What was on Aaron's ephod? Do you remember? Well, there was those 12 stones. Of course, that represented one for each tribe. But then there was something else that was on the ephod that the priest made use of. I heard it. The Urim and the Thummim. Now, we don't know all what was involved in that, but what was that used for? The priest would use the Urim and the Thummim for what purpose? Yes, we're going to inquire of the Lord on a certain matter, and again, however that process worked, they were able to determine God was saying yes or God was saying no. And so it was for the purpose of the priest inquiring of the will of God on various matters. Now, for Micah to set up this shrine in his house and set the idols up, now he's made an ephod. What does that indicate to you? Why would he make an ephod? All right, and does he have a priest in his shrine? He doesn't? Yeah, his son's going to be his priest. Now, he's going to change that just in a little bit, but at least where it stands right now, you'll see there in verse 5, the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols, and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. So, with the son wearing the ephod, serving as priest, what's he wanting the son to do? Make inquiry of his idea of God, whether it's to his idols, or whether it's to Jehovah, or maybe his brother Lambert's, maybe it's just a convoluted mixture of both. Now, there's a big problem with that arrangement, isn't there? I mean, that's just not going to work. Yes, that's true. That is the way things are now. In that day and in our days too. We have all these religious ideas mixed up, and some of them have just enough of a smattering of truth to make them seem somewhat credible and legitimate, when in reality, how true is it to the book? It's not true at all. It's far away from the plan of the ideal of God. So Micah sets up his shrine, and that's there in verse through verse 5. So again, these verses continue the theme that's been shown throughout all this book. We've seen it through every story of this guy so far with these respective judges. Pitiful spiritual conditions in Israel that exist in these days. And everything in the story so far, at least to me, suggests that Micah and his mother had a complete disregard for the true worship of Jehovah. What had God said back in the commandments? Exodus 20, verses 4 through 6. I'm a jealous God, have no gods before me, thou shalt not do what? Make any graven images. And what have they done? They've gone exactly against that commandment. So they have no desire, they have no real intention to serve God and worship God in the way that He has specified. They're just happy and content to do it this way. How many folks do we know? How many folks, maybe even in our own families, are content to worship God with the way that they're doing it, and no matter what passage you may show them or talk to them as kindly as you can, they just can't be convinced. A lot of folks are still that way. They're just convinced that their way is all right because they're sincere about it. Therefore, then God must be pleased with that worship. Okay. Now, verse 6 is just sort of a one statement all by itself, but it serves as a reminder of, I think, of why we have all this idolatrous cancer. Yes, one of the best known verses, not in just the book, but the whole Bible. In those days, there was absence of what? There was no king in Israel. Now, let's stop right there. Was there a king in Israel? Yes, because in 1 Samuel chapter 8, when we bring in the kingdom, remember what Israel said? Make for us a king like all the other nations. We don't have one. They've got one. And they made that request of Samuel. That displeased Samuel. He took this concern to the Lord. And remember what the Lord said? Samuel, they've not rejected you. They've rejected me from being king. So to say that there was no king is not totally true. The statement just means there's no man on earth sitting on a throne in front of them, one that they could see and touch and talk to, that they could physically see. No king in Israel. And so how does the verse conclude? Anarchy. Is the last part of verse 6 objective or subjective? It's entirely subjective. Who decides what's right based on verse 6? Every man. Micah decided this was right. Micah's mother decided this is what we need to do about this situation, so that's what they chose to do. Now, I don't think we have to stretch ourselves very far, do we, brethren, to see that verse 6 could just as easily apply to our situation today, couldn't it? I mean, that's the culture we live in. Whether it's socially and all the family problems we've got, whether it's legally and citizens just thumbing their nose at laws and dictates that's on the books, even something as simple as speeding, not observing speeding laws. Whether you're talking about religiously, we've gotten to the point now where we think what? Well, I'm going to do what I want to do, and you can do what you want to do, and I won't condemn you, and you don't condemn me. Everybody's right. Well, can everybody be right? Not that way they can't. They can be if we all agree to abide by the one objective standard. Then we can all be right. But this way, this is chaos. This is total chaos or anarchy, as Brother Lambert suggested. Okay, so that's Micah's situation. That's how he set this up. So the story so far does sound very modern. And what you get in the absence of objective standards is religious potpourry, isn't it? It's just all thrown in there together. It may look good and it may smell nice, but it's not worth much. That's right. Whatever smells good to you. Okay, so this is sort of where I was going with this is the question 6, the thought question on page 36. You know, what does all this mixing of different religious ideas remind you of today? Well, it's modern denominationalism, and we're not here to slam anybody personally. We're just looking at what's believed and what's taught, what's practiced, and how far away is a lot of religion in America that's practiced? How far away is it from the objective standard? Some of it's way out there. Some of it's closer than others, but it's, you know, if it's not this, then it's wrong. And so we want to do what's right, of course. We want to please God, not please man. Okay. Now that's how chapter 17 begins. Now another person comes on the scene, and it adds another element to the story. Who are we introduced to in verse 7? Okay. He's a young man who is a Levite, who was currently staying where? All right, he was in Bethlehem of Judah. And so he strikes out on his own. Verse 8 says, the man departed from the city, from Bethlehem in Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place. So he's just launching out, and whatever his motive was, maybe he went out to do this or that, or something's something's driving him to take this trip. So he just launches out, and there he goes. Well, who does he come in contact with? He comes in contact with Micah in Ephraim. He meets Micah. Micah does what? Micah questions him, doesn't he? Verse 9. He says, well, okay, where do you come from? Who are you? Where do you come from? He says, I'm a Levite from Bethlehem, and I'm going to stay wherever I may find a place. I don't really have any plans. I'm just going. Well, what is Micah? How does Micah respond to that? You get this idea that the light bulb clicked on over Micah's head when he hears this? This guy's a Levite. Now, and chapter 17, the way that it ends, verse 13, indicates to me that Micah thought doing what he's going to do here in the next few verses, again, would add legitimacy, some credibility to his shrine. So when the young man says, I'm not really going anywhere, I'm just going wherever I can find a place to stay. So Micah says, well, how about you stay with me? I'll hire you. I'll make you my priest. Is he going to pay him pretty good? Seems like it is. That's right. He offers him, verse 10. 10 pieces of silver a year, clothing, and I'll maintain your living. You can stay with me. You can, food, room and board, all those kinds of things. You can stay with me. What's the Levite say? Sounds good to me. I had nowhere else to go, and might as well stay here. So the young Levite accepts. And verse 11. Well, verse 10. Did Micah tell him what his intentions were going to be? He says, let me be a father to you, and you be my priest. Now, let's stop right here for the moment, and let's ask this question. This is a Levite. You think he knows anything at all about the requirements that the law places upon one being a priest? I would think that he would. He's from the right tribe. Could this man be a priest? We don't know. He could be if, what? If he's from the right tribe. He's got to be of the family of Aaron, though. Could all Levites be priests? No, he had to be from the family of Aaron. But all priests were Levites, because Aaron was from Levi. So, perhaps he could be a priest. Well, even if he could, what kind of priest is he going to be? And what's going to be the setup? Idolatry in this shrine that Micah has set up. So even if he were from Aaron's family, his priesthood or his priestly duties would still be illegitimate because he's practicing idolatry. Now, what if he's not from Aaron's family, but he's just a Levite? Then what should he have known? And what should he have said? I can't be a priest. I'm not from the right family. So either way we go with this young man is accepting his employment that he shouldn't accept. I shouldn't do this. This is not right. But he does agree. He does accept. Perhaps his motivation was that pay sounds pretty good. Whatever his motive was, he accepts. And so the situation concludes that, Micah thinking having a Levite would bring legitimacy to his shrine. There's no indication that the young Levite was from the family of Aaron, but it seems to me that both Micah and this young Levite bore guilt in engaging in proper worship. Obviously they did. Micah setting up the shrine in the first place violates the law. And then this young man going to serve as priest in front of these false gods, these idols, that's going to be an abomination to the Lord as well. All right, very good point. What right would Micah have to consecrate this young man into the priesthood, so to speak? He wouldn't have that right. He's usurping that authority, if you will. So either the young Levite was ignorant of the law regarding the priesthood and worship, or he just knew better and still willingly disobeyed for the sake of monetary gain. He's got some reason for doing this, for agreeing to it. And it's going to put him at odds with the law and with the Lord. So for Micah, and again, here's an application, and I think a lot of people fall into this category. For Micah, religion seemed to be a very private matter, didn't it? He set these gods up in his house in private, in secret. And he invented his entire system of worship. And a lot of people are that way, aren't they? How I worship God, well, that's between me and God. Well, in her manner of speaking, is that true? I mean, it is after a fashion, isn't it? But still, what must be in place? Yeah, it's got to be in accordance with how God has said He wants to be worshipped in His Word. Now, if we both agree to worship God based on biblical dictates, what God has said in His commands, then do I have a personal access to God, and you have one as well? Yes, we do. We're all His children individually, but that doesn't mean that I can then worship Him any way that I want to. And you can do the same, and if we don't pick the same way, well, after all, it's a private matter. It's between me and God. That's not encouraged or ever taught in the Scripture. And Micah seems to be having this idea that, I'm sincere about this. And I've added a legitimate element of a Levitical priest here, so to speak. Then surely God's going to be pleased with that. And isn't that how verse 13 reads? So verse 12, Micah consecrates the Levite. The young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, chapter 17 concludes, Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing what? I've got a Levite now." See, that makes it all okay. So if I'm pleased with it, then God's got to be pleased with it, because after all, I've added a Levite to this arrangement here. And again, we don't say this lightly, but that's the thinking of a lot of denominational folk. I'm happy with it. I'm sincere about it. Therefore, I just think God's going to be pleased with this. Okay. Anything through chapter 17 that anybody has? It's a real short story. At least this half of it is. And we've pretty much covered all the doings from that chapter. Okay, now, sort of laying that episode aside, at least for the moment, Micah and his young Levite, now we switch our attention to talk about who? Oh, the men of Dan, the tribe of Dan. And here is verse 1. This gets us now to question 10, bottom of page 36. The story of the Danites. So again, the first part of verse 1, what point is repeated? What are we reminded of again? Okay, there's no king. Just to remind us that, that's why we're having all this anarchy and all this chaotic behavior that's not in agreement with the law. And the tribe of Dan sought for an inheritance. Verse 1 tells us why. Okay. All right, Bernie. It says, in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for themselves to live in, for until that day, an inheritance had not been allotted to them as a possession among the tribes of Israel. Well, that's what it says. If you just were to read that and look at that verse by itself, what's that sound like? Yeah, it sounds like God overlooked these people. He didn't provide for them. Everybody else got their allotment, their inheritance. And for some reason, they didn't get there. One had not been allotted to the tribe of Dan. So, let's examine that just for the moment. One might get the wrong conclusion. Well, Joshua didn't do his job. And better yet, Joshua, representing God in the matter, God didn't do his job either. Now, that's pretty serious thing to think, isn't it? But do we know whether that's true or not? We know that that's not true. We know that's not the right conclusion to form. And look at the passages that are listed in question 10, bottom of page 36. All right, let's go back right quick for the moment and go back to Joshua chapter 19. Pardon? Yes, Joshua 19. And looking at verses 40 through 48 together, as Brother Lambert points out, verse 7, not only did Dan get an allotment, but what was the pecking order? They went seventh. So there were even others after them. So we can't say that, well, Dan got overlooked. No, not, I mean, he wasn't even last. He was seventh. And you'll read verses 40 through 48. Just look at those verses, and as you read them, you can see the places that's listed. The law gave, or not the law, but the book of Joshua here gave the landmarks, if you will, the boundaries of the allotment of Dan. And we're going to, again, show a map here just in a few minutes to remind ourselves of where Dan's allotment was. Perhaps you've got a map in the back of your Bible, and you've been looking at it throughout these studies. You can see where Dan had his inheritance. So we know that's not correct. But one more verse I want to look at, and we'll come back and look at verse 47 again, specifically. But look at chapter 21 of Joshua, verses 43 through 45. We will read these. All right? Joshua 21, verse 43. Doug, if you'll read the last three verses for us from that chapter. So what's that say about the giving of the inheritance?
Joshua did his job.
That's right. Joshua did his job, and God did his. In fact, as Joshua writes here, not a word of the Lord failed in the matter. Everything that was promised came to pass. Well, okay, but we've got a failure somewhere because, as this story says, Dan didn't have all of their inheritance. Well, where did the fault lie? It wasn't God or Joshua, so whose fault was it? It was the Danites' fault. Now, back to Judges 1 and verse 34. Let's go back to the first chapter of Judges. And we went through these verses rather hurriedly when we went through chapter 1, just to sort of give us an idea of overall what was happening to all the tribes of Israel. Judges 1, verse 34. How does that verse describe the Danites? Well, was that Roger? That's right, they're stuck on a mountain. The Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the valley. Well, how much crops can you grow in the mountains? When you got good bottom land down there, you can't use it, because Dan failed to do what? And not just Dan, but the previous verses as well. How were all these tribes described? Yeah, they didn't run out all the Canaanites out of their land. And they sort of quit on their inheritance. So the failure lies with Dan, not with God or with Joshua. So back in our text today, chapter 18, when it says in verse 1 that an inheritance had not been allotted to them as a possession, well, it had, but they didn't clear it. They didn't guarantee it for themselves. They didn't totally make themselves available of it. Yes. Oh, yeah, they didn't guard it. They didn't try to win it over. So now, if they had followed what God said, then would they have had enough land? Because after all, who decided the individual allotments? God did. And He certainly knew the needs of this tribe, how much land they would need. Now, obviously, Dan wasn't as big a tribe as, say, Manasseh or Judah. They required more land, but they had sufficient. If they had just done what God had said, then they wouldn't have had this problem. Now, I said we were going to look at real quickly Joshua 19 and verse 47. Turn back and read that just real quickly. And we'll put this, I think, in a context. To me, this is the indication that the first appendix here that we're looking at today, chapters 17 and 18, happened not long after the death of Joshua and very early on in the days of the judges. Maybe even perhaps before Othniel became the first judge. I don't know exactly when. But you'll see in Joshua 19, verse 47, what's recorded in that verse? Well, the territory of the sons of Dan proceeded beyond them, for the sons of Dan went up and fought with Leshem. Well, that will also be Laish, which we'll see in a moment. And captured it. They struck it with the edge of the sword and possessed it. and settled in it. And they called Leshem Dan after the name of Dan their father. Well, that one verse just by itself is now going to be described in more detail where? Judges 18. And the story of the Danites migrating north to capture that land. So the fact that Joshua writes about it back there indicates that this story now we're going to study happens very early on in the days of the Judges. Again, perhaps not long after Joshua himself died. Because he does die at the end of the book of Joshua and the start of the book of Judges. Those two overlap one another. So that's the indication to me that it's early on in the process. So okay, that's a good point, Freddie. Freddie reminds us at the end of Joshua's book, and say in chapter 24 of his address, he encourages them to put away the gods. You know, choose you this day whom you'll serve. You're going to follow these gods. Well, what gods might he have been referring to? I think it's obvious he's referring to this kind of activity that was still going on as they began to take possession of their land. So that text there harmonizes with what we read here in Judges 18, and that tells us that it's fairly early on in the days of the judges. Okay, well, that's their decision that they make. We've got to. I get the idea that they're overcrowded where they are. They're all stuck up there in the mountains. They can't make themselves available to the good bottom land down below in the valley. So we've got to solve this crowded problem. And so, verse 2, what did the Danite leaders decide to do? All right. Have spies worked pretty good in the past? They've used spies before. Moses sent spies out to spy the land of Canaan. And so now the Danite leaders said, okay, let's pick. How many did they pick? They chose five men. We'll call them spies. Chose five men from the Danites, and they said, verse 2 describes them as valiant men from Zorah and Eshtaol. You go spy out the land and search it out. Now, did they say where to go? Did they say to go up north to Laish? They didn't say that. Just go find something somewhere. Go find land for us. So they just were sent out to solve this problem, to locate land that would solve their problem. So they go north. They leave Dan. Let's see if my map is not next. Let me get to my map here. There we go. Okay. Now, down here, there's Dan right there. And this territory, when God gave the allotment, obviously God thought that was going to be enough to meet this tribe's needs. Well, keeping that map up there, when they leave Dan, where do they go first? They go through Ephraim. Now, Ephraim is next. It's just right there to the north and the east. So these two tribal areas, they join. Like states or counties. I mean, their borders touch one another. And we'll see that they come to the... This is verse 2. They come to the hill country of Ephraim. Well, now, who lives there? Micah. That's how these stories are going to overlap. Micah lives there. So they come in contact with Micah. And when they come to Micah's house, verse 3, there's something in verse 3 that gives us information that we don't know why, but how it worked out. They recognized whose voice? The priest. They recognized the voice of the young man, the Levite. Now, I wonder how they knew that. Okay. Well, Freddie suggests that they bordered with Benjamin. At some point their path had to cross because they recognized this young man. Okay. Okay. Maybe not him specifically, but maybe he talked in a way. Yes, Freddie's point is, see, that was at the end of the story of, where was that? Sibboleth and Shibboleth. That was in, chapter 12, Jephthah, yeah. So perhaps it was his speech that indicated he was from the tribe of Levi. For whatever reason, the Bible just says that they recognized his voice. And so what did they do next? Yeah, Well, first thing they ask, they say, who brought you here? Yeah, what are you doing here? And what have you, what do you have here? You know, tell us about your situation. So what does the young man say? Verse 4. Well, Micah's sort of set me up. I'm in his employ now. I'm his priest. He provides for me. This is sort of where I live now and what I do. And so after they hear that he's serving as a priest, now verse 5, what do they say? Yeah, do the work of a priest and inquire of the Lord to see if so that we may know whether our way on which we are going will be prosperous. You know, we've just sort of struck out here, but we need to ask the Lord's blessings on this. So tell us if this is going to work out or not. And what does the Levite do? Verse 6. Everything's fine. Go in peace. God's going to approve this. There's no problem. Okay, Freddie's point is, does the text say that he made inquiry of the Lord? Doesn't say that, does it? Now, he could have, it just didn't say, but it doesn't say it. That's a good point to bring out. So we'll start here Wednesday night. So they come to Ephraim, but then the next verse says they go way up there, and there's the extra territory of Dan, top of the map. Way northern Judah. And that's why.